and above, and then tomorrow it looks like we got some snow on the way, maybe about an inch by the time it's all done. Thursday's high, 14. Thursday night's low, down to, oh, yeah, there it is, one above. I was looking at a few numbers. I thought, where is it? It's the one above zero. So Friday, it looks like we're going to get seven above, and Friday night, a low around zero. So no wind chill factor in there, but still bitterly cold, dangerously cold, 17 right now in downtown Butler. I'm Tracy Morgan in the Next Tier Bank studios. Next Tier Bank, your hometown community bank. Your news time is just about 12:31. Dave Malarkey is coming up next with It's Your Turn. Don't forget, you can always get news anytime on demand on our website at butlerradio.com. You can also get news on Alexa-powered devices. You download the Butler Radio News Skill and say, Alexa, what's in the news? All right, so thanks so much for joining us. Stay warm and keep all that skin covered. Stay inside if you can. Have a great day.
And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn. Weekdays from 1230 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn. 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Stop and Think. Yeah, Wednesday edition of It's Your Turn. Are you still a little bit confused after two straight long holiday weekends? I think everybody is, yeah. Wednesday. And it's January 3rd. And it's another cold day, although temperatures are warming up just a little bit, and we expect to be for a couple of hours at least in the 20s today, which ordinarily would still be pretty cold, but compared to what we've had, you know, yesterday's high was 12, and the day before, New Year's Day, the high was 12, and we're looking at temperatures tomorrow, high tomorrow 14, and I think Friday 7 for a high, yeah. And we do plan to break out of this. At least the weather folks are telling us we will by Sunday. And that'll be a relief. But we'll enjoy, at least for a while, temperatures in the 20s, low 20s this afternoon. And nice sunshine as well. We have some good stuff lined up for you on the program. We're making arrangements next week. I think it's going to be Wednesday of next week. We're still finalizing that. Kristen Hibbs will be chatting with us. Kristen is a native of Butler, graduated of Butler High School, I think, some years ago. But she has lived and worked in the United Kingdom for several years now. She is a curator and a designer for one of the big museums in London. Now, she generally comes home over the holidays, and we've had the pleasure of chatting with her a couple of times. And next week she's going to be back in Butler, so we'll let you know. I think it's going to be Wednesday of next week. She'll be chatting with us. We'll get an update with Krista. It's always nice to find somebody who, you know, what an exciting career, you know, to live and work not only in another place, but in another part of the world. Yeah. Coming up later this week, tomorrow, we'll be chatting with Larry Black and Michael Harvey about pro-life issues. These are two guests who have long been champions of pro-life issues. We've visited with them in the past, and we'll enjoy another conversation with them tomorrow. Also tomorrow, Living with Less. And boy, what a great time of the year to talk about this. You know, after the excess, for most of us at least, over the holidays, whether it was eating or too much, or maybe, you know, maybe for the kids, too many toys, right? Yeah. Living with Less. We'll be talking tomorrow with Courtney Carver about that. Now, we had to scramble at the last minute today to change our program schedule around a little bit. We're still going to be meeting a brand new Penn State educator later on the program today. But the first portion of the program, we were originally scheduled to chat with folks from the Boy Scouts of America. But, boy, I don't have to tell you how sickness has overtaken so many people. And so our guests notified us at the last minute that they weren't going to be able to be here today. And we understand that, and we'll hopefully be able to reschedule their visit. But we understand people are sick. I was talking to a couple of folks earlier this week, yesterday. Yeah, and even on Monday, I saw some folks, and they said, boy, sore throat, respiratory infection, cough, yeah. Some folks have had it for a couple of weeks. So, yeah, it's this time of year. You know, it's the flu season, and we understand that. But we are going to listen to an interview that we did with a man by the name of Jim Hollick, who Butler native, and he went on to a career as a corrections officer. And he has written a riveting story about a crime spree that gripped a nation. And it all happened locally. It all happened locally here in our area. So we'll be anxious to take a listen to that. Jim Hollick will be visiting with us in just a couple of minutes here. Meanwhile, nice to have you here on the It's Your Turn program today. We were talking earlier today on the morning show with our colleague Kate about, I don't know how it came up, to be honest with you, I never know. We're talking about candy bars. And I said that the cheapest candy bar I can ever remember was something called a lunch bar, and it cost 3 cents. I don't think they make them anymore. I don't know. I don't buy much candy anymore. I certainly don't buy it by the bar like you used to whenever you were a kid. Go into the store and buy a candy bar. It cost 3 cents. Yeah. And we were talking about Zagnuts, Zagnut bars, which they still make, it turns out. Haven't seen those in ages. Lunch bar. Anybody remember that? Lunch bar? Came in a green wrapper, that's all I can tell you. And it was chocolate of some sort, whether it was a wafer or, you know, a chocolate-covered... I really don't remember. But I can remember because back in those days, when you had 3 cents, man, you were living. You know, I had 3 cents to burn on a candy bar on the way home from school. Well, okay, we'll take a break here, and then we'll be chatting with Jim Hollick, James G. Hollick, about this. And I got to warn you, it's a pretty gruesome story. It's a pretty violent story, crime spree, but it took place here. And it was back in the late 1960s. So if you were around then, if you were living in this area, maybe you'll remember. We'll visit it in just a moment or so when we chat with Jim Hollick here on the It's Your Turn program on a Wednesday. And we'll be right back.
Did you know that if you are a chiropractic patient at Applewood Chiropractic, a wellness program with unlimited use of their executive-level fitness center may be covered by your insurance? Personalized wellness plans are designed to assist patients with treatment and preventative care. In addition to unlimited use of their safe, clean, non-intimidating fitness center, wellness plans include discounts on additional chiropractic visits, supplements, and 6 bioimpedance analyses per year. To learn more, call Applewood Chiropractic Health and Fitness Center, 724-2830. Or visit applewoodchiro.com.
I am most anxious to say hello and talk to our guest. His name is Jim Hollick. He is, for the purposes of our discussion today, he's the author of a book called Born to Lose, Stanley B. Haas and the Crime Spree That Gripped the Nation. But very importantly for our purposes as well, he is a Butler native. So he's a local guy, and I meet him for the first time today as he sits here across the table from me. Jim Hollick, nice to say hello.
Very nice to be here, Dave.
I learned about your book fairly recently, and our production team. I had a meeting, and somebody said, "Do you want to talk to him?" And I said, "You bet I do. let's get him in here for an interview as quickly as we can. First of all, you're a local guy, and secondly, this is a fascinating book. Is this the first book you've written?"
It is, although it took a while. It was sort of like, sort of wanted to be an author, and then I had some other ideas, but you know the phrase, write what you know, mm-hmm. and I happened to be in the criminal justice system at Western Penitentiary, and there was no other criminal as infamous as Stanley Haas.
Stanley Haas, yeah.
And the more I looked into it, I said, well, this is indeed, it's just not a routine criminal. This is indeed a rather fascinating, complex, detailed story. So it took me about 12 years, Dave, to write, researched 5 years before I wrote a single word. So, and then after that, you just continue to learn as you go along. So it was quite a bit of work, but I loved it all.
Stanley Haas, there's another local angle for us, and it's another reason why I wanted to talk to Jim right away. Stanley Haas, the Tarentum man who killed a Verona police officer. Stanley Haas, I'm not sure whether he was born in Saxonburg, but didn't he grow up in Saxonburg?
Well, yes, indeed, he was born there as well, on March 1st, 1943. You could say born and raised in Saxonburg, mm-hmm. yes.
When did this violent story take place? We have to set the time frame a little bit.
Sure.
I know when the name Stanley Haas was mentioned, I had this vague recollection. You know, the name sounded familiar.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But I wouldn't have been able to put the pieces together.
My book begins, there's some variances where I might go back to where he was closer to his childhood years, mm-hmm. to give the reader some understanding of his upbringing and so forth. But for general purposes, my book begins in the springtime of 1969, and it opens with an abduction of a young Shaler, teenage girl from her neighborhood streets, and she's taken by Haas and another partner in crime, and accosted sexually, but she gets out of this alive. And then there's another home invasion where a woman is assaulted, and then he is sort of on the run. He's wanted. And I don't know how much further you want me to go right now, because you just said, well, yeah, but to say the story begins in 1969.
He was no longer living in Saxonburg, right? He was living in Tarentum.
Well, that's
that
correct. He's a Butler County guy, mm-hmm. But at this point, he'd lived in various places, mostly in the northern suburbs, northern areas, north of Pittsburgh.
Was he gainfully employed, or was he a ne'er-do-well, or what was he doing in Shaler?
He
abducted this young girl, is that right, or just sexually assaulted her?
In what I just mentioned?
Yeah.
Let's just go back to one thing. He was a bona fide ne'er-do-well.
Okay.
And like many of the criminal class, he was a little bit above work, but at times he did work. I recall once he worked for a brief period of time as a truck driver, but his primary occupation, if you'd want to say he had one, was that of a gravedigger. And for a time when he was younger, his dad worked at Lakeview Cemetery, and he was a caretaker, and so the Haas family actually had a house on the property. So they were doing pretty well for themselves at the time. And Stanley Haas took up that profession, for a while.
Mm-hmm. Oh, bit of a macabre twist to the whole story. He's a gravedigger.
Yeah, there were some funny goings on at some of these cemeteries where he was involved with.
So this is late 60s, 1969.
Yes.
The girl in question from Shaler, did you say?
Yes,
she
I did.
Managed to get away. She lived.
Well, he did let her off under threats. You say anything, and you know I will come back. I'll hurt your family. Things like that.
Did she go to the police or?
Well, she had planned to be a martyr and say I can't go to the police. He'll hurt my family. But in the end, she was so jittery that her family noticed it and. And then it all came out. They did go to the police. Haas was being looked for then, or at least not. They didn't know who he was, but at least the description of him, his criminal buddy, and the brand new gleaming red Corvette they were driving around. And it was this was on Good Friday when the girl was abducted, and the following Sunday, Easter, he was pulled over, and he was eventually questioned, went to jail. And this led to a daring rooftop escape. In the interim, he was convicted of this rape of this teenage girl. Mm-hmm. So for the first time in his life, he was looking at some big time, you know, 10 to 20 years.
We're talking about Stanley Haas, an infamous murderer. He was later a convicted murderer, right?
Indeed.
A criminal. Good for nothing hoodlum from here in our area back in the late 60s. And why are we talking about him? We certainly don't want to glorify him or his life, but our guest, Jim Hollick, has written a book. The title of the book is Born to Lose, Stanley B. Haas and the Crime Spree That Gripped a Nation. And by the way, on the cover of your book, there's a is that the car they were driving around, or is that just
well,
some other car?
That comes a little bit later, Dave, so we can get into that in a few minutes.
Well, my first thought was, if he's raped a girl, she's gone to the police. Mm. They have his description, and they're looking for him.
Indeed.
And he's driving around in a red Corvette. It's not one of your brighter bulbs, I would have to say. I mean,
you know, you're right about that, and as well, that is a, I guess, a characteristic of the criminal class. But I will say this about Stanley Haas. Of the criminal class, he was probably a little brighter than most. Now, this is not to say these guys are geniuses. And, you know, you've often heard maybe on television, oh, he's a brilliant criminal. Mm-hmm. I mean, I say there isn't any such thing as a brilliant criminal. Mm-hmm. But, yes, he was still 2 days after this rape, they still had possession of this gleaming red Corvette, and he was pulled over.
So he was convicted of the rape. He was sentenced to jail time. Where did he go? Where did they?
Well, what happened was he was convicted. Rape of this girl, the teenager, took place in April, Good Friday, April 4, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. And in July, he was convicted of this rape, and he was sent to the county jail, Allegheny County Jail, initially. But then it was so overcrowded and there was a lot of difficulties. They just went down through their roster, grabbed 300 guys, Haas among them, and sent them to the Allegheny County Workhouse in Blonox at the time, which was about 100 years old. And Haas was just gleeful that he was picked to go there because he considered it, quote, soft. And his full intent was to escape because he was now facing 10 to 20 years, and there was no doubt he was going to get every day of that.
How old was he?
In other words, he was convicted but unsentenced, and he was going to be soon sentenced. Mm-hmm. And pending sentencing, he was at the workhouse. And he was 26 at the time.
Hmm. There isn't still an Allegheny County workhouse, is there?
No, but you can go by. There's the foundations along Freeport Road in Blonox there. So you can see old remnants of the workhouse.
Was it like a work release place?
No. This was a big major prison. It contained criminals from the western, I think, 30 counties, or about half the state, the western counties. And you could do time anywhere from 30 days to 30 years at this workhouse.
What did they do there? I mean, did it actually work?
I'm sorry?
Did the prisoners actually work there?
Well, some did and some didn't. Now, Stanley Haas, when he got there, it was a big, many farm grounds, you know, so, and there were chickens, cattle, orchards, all of these things where your better guys could be put out, the safer ones could be put out to work.
I misunderstood. I thought that it was like a license plate manufacturing facility or something like that.
No.
Okay. So it was more of a working farm.
More dangerous people, such as Stanley Hoss. They were facing rape. They were not going to put him outside the Great Walls to go milk cows because he'd bolt. So they kept him inside on a loom or a textile kind of little situation in there.
So this is midsummer of 1969 now.
This is midsummer and up through September. On September 11, 1969, this is where he made this daring rooftop escape with another criminal buddy of his named Tom Lubruski, and they succeeded. And it was quite a remarkable feat because it was going up through a skylight, bars, sawn, through. Uh-huh. It was old Civil War steel that they could pull this off. And they did. They escaped, and by golly, if they had not been able to escape, had things, maybe security been a little better, but I must say, no matter what, criminals just sit around and think all day how to escape, so they have, maybe a step on the routine staff. But had that not occurred, then none of this, we wouldn't be sitting here, because the great crimes begin shortly after that escape.
Well, let's take a break and pick that up. Is it then that the police officers murdered shortly after this?
Shortly after the escape, yes.
Okay. Well, we'll pick up that part of the story. My mind needs refreshing as well. We're talking, listeners, with Jim Hollick. He's a Butler. Have you graduated from Butler High School?
I did.
Did you move away after that?
I went to college and then came back to Butler for a while. And then I worked in a couple different fields, mostly my major, where what I went to college for. Then I sort of broke away from that, and I wound up just sort of a bit of a quirk somehow. I wound up taking a position at Western Penitentiary, which turned out to be my career for 30 years.
Hmm. We'll continue our conversation with Jim Hollick. He's researched the Stanley Haas case, which up to this point, it's riveting, but it's... And obviously there was a tragic rape involved here, but it gets much, much more violent and much sadder. And when we pick up the story, we'll do that in just a couple of minutes here on It's Your Turn on WISR. We'll be back right after this. The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary, and the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler.
Get your tickets now for the 12th Annual Butler County Wine Festival, presented by WISR and Deal Automotive. Scheduled for January 27th at the Butler Days Inn, the festival features Pennsylvania wineries, food and specialty vendors, food samples, and a basket raffle to benefit the YMCA's Strong Kids program. Choose from two sessions, 2 to 5 or 6 to 9. Our premier ticket includes a souvenir wine tasting glass and a voucher for our refreshment booth. Tickets are $20 pre-sale and are limited for each session. For complete details and to purchase your tickets, visit butlerradio.com.
Welcome back, listeners. Great to have you with us today. And I've not been disappointed so far. I told you when we started that I was anxiously waiting the chance to meet Jim Hollick and talk to him. We had not met before he came into the studio today. We're talking about a riveting story, Born to Lose, but it's just nice to meet him. And we were chatting during the break there because we had mentioned that he graduated from Butler High School. You were a football player for Butler High.
I was a football player in what I like to call our glory years.
Terry Hanratty.
I played with great guys. Terry Hanratty was our quarterback. He was a senior and I was a junior. Mm-hmm. But the teams that followed were tremendous. We had Mike Kelly, now congressman. Our wonderful two-way lineman for Butler High. Rich and Ron Saul, of course, we all know about, as high school All-Americans. Both went on to play college at Michigan State, then the pros at Washington, mm-hmm. and the LA Rams, I believe. And sadly, as we all know, around here, Rich Saul passed away a couple months ago.
Yeah. We're talking with Jim Hollick, and specifically today we're talking about his book, Born to Lose, Stanley B. Haas and the Crime Spree That Gripped a Nation. Okay, let's pick up the story. Stanley Haas has been convicted of raping a girl in Shaler, convicted but not yet sentenced. He knew he was going to do hard time, long time. He breaks out of the Allegheny County Workhouse. I'm assuming that right away there's an all-points bulletin. This guy's on the loose. Let's try to find him.
There is an all-points bulletin. He's not yet the status that he will very soon become, but my goodness, he's an escaped convict and a convicted rapist. So, yeah, there are a lot of people looking for him. There are even sightings. There was a great big, hunt for him in Fawn Township, about 3 or 4 days after he escaped.
That's but then he sort of northern North Hills of Pittsburgh,
yes,
by the way.
It is. Well, it's around the Trona Heights, Fawn Township. Mm-hmm. But, you know, then he sort of disappeared for a few more days, and no one knew where he was. But, in fact, he had made his way to Cleveland, where he did steal another car. And lo and behold, he is driving back to Pittsburgh, probably. Oh, and he is sighted at a Winkie's restaurant. There's old Winkies.
I remember
that old date us, Dave.
They were the worst hamburgers in the world, but they were only 20 cents.
They're only 20 cents. That'll keep you coming back. So, an old chum from high school he knew of, or they knew each other, recognized Stanley Haas and called the cops once Stanley left and said, well, he's going down Washington Boulevard now. When he gets to the bottom, he's either going to turn left toward Pittsburgh or right toward Verona. So they notified them both. So Stanley Haas does go down to the bottom of the hill, turns right toward Verona, and I'm suspecting he was going to visit his mistress who lived in one of the river towns mm-hmm. along there. So, Joe Zanella, this wonderful young man, he was 25 years old, just a year younger than Stanley Haas, was the policeman on duty. He got the bulletin to take a look out for this, yellow Ford with a white convertible top. And that's what Haas had stolen in Cleveland. And I don't want to get into too many details here because there's just so much information. Mm-hmm. But Joe Zanella, the policeman, pulls along to Allegheny River Boulevard where he's going to just sit there and watch the cars go by, see if he can see it. And no sooner did he get to the boulevard that the car did go by. So he pulls out behind and he calls on his radio, the communications center. And that's another whole story about how convoluted these communication center can be, and you don't have quite direct access to your own station, mm-hmm. really. But he notified others that, hey, this is Stanley Haas. He's in this stolen car that was reported. I'm following him. I'm going to go for a pullover along Verona, or the upcoming next town would be Oakmont. And so he did call for backup, and indeed he did pull Stanley Haas over just in the first territories of Oakmont on Plum Street. And he waited for backup, but he thought Haas would take off at any moment. They were both stopped now. And so he got out of the car, and he didn't know if Stanley Haas was armed. There was no reports of him being armed, but he was. And he stuck a 22 handgun out the window and pulled off two quick shots. And one of them whizzed by Joe Zanella's head, and the other one crashed right into his chest. And there he dropped this wonderful cop, Joe Zanella, and then, boom, takes off. And now you want to talk about a manhunt? This turned into the greatest manhunt in Pennsylvania history, and it just kept evolving and evolving.
Was the police officer dead on the spot?
According to testimony later on in a trial by the renowned Dr. Cyril Wecht, Dr. Weck stated that the policeman with that wound, it went right into it, pierced his heart, mm-hmm. could have lived no longer than 1 to 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. So we didn't, no one knew if he was alive. They got him in an ambulance, but you still can't tell if someone's alive. Yeah, but he was pronounced dead at the hospital.
So now, police officer murdered by an escaped convict, convicted rapist. They're really after him.
No? And keep in mind, this is 43 years ago. It's not like today where we hear these very bad things all the time. I've sometimes likened it to having John Dillinger pull into Mayberry and gunning down Andy Griffith. Mm. You know, it just was almost unheard of on a beautiful autumn afternoon such as that.
You know, you make a point there, Jim. Jim Hollick is our guest, listeners, if you're listening in the car and you just turn the radio on. We're talking about his book, Born to Lose, Stanley B. Haas and the Crime Spree that Gripped the Nation. You're right. Today, you turn on the TV news at night, murder in Wilkinsburg, shooting in Homewood, shooting in Crafton. I mean, sometimes I think the Pittsburgh area is like the Old West. It wasn't that way 43 years ago.
No.
And certainly when you had a police officer shot and killed, that was, I mean, it wasn't unheard of, but that was a shocker.
You paid attention.
Yeah. So what happened? Did they catch this guy
in short order? That's
or?
The interesting part. He was not caught. And I mean hundreds. I mean Pittsburgh, all the northern police stations, they sent every possible man. A brother was down. A brother now, very shortly it was found out, a brother has been murdered, a police officer. And so all available resources were brought to bear. And Stanley Haas kept getting away. There were sightings here, sightings there, and he kept slipping through the net. And he would hide out, you know, sometimes who knows where, but, you know, through enough research and learning more as I went along studying this case, he did hide in cemeteries. He was familiar with cemeteries. He knew the come and go of cemeteries. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it was now 2 days after the cop killing, which occurred on September 19, 1969. I don't want to get too bogged down in dates because they're hard to remember. But a couple days later, it was a Sunday, and this lovely young woman, 20 years old, I give her a false name in the book just to protect her identity because she's alive and well now
still
in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
But she was kneeling at her father's gravesite, of all places. Well, I mean, she went to visit. Her father recently passed away. She's there on her knees saying a prayer, and Stanley Haas comes up behind her, puts a gun to her head, and said, "Do you know who I am?" And she looks up and recognizes from all the pictures that have been in the papers, yes, I do. I know who you are. He said, "Well, good. Now get up. Yeah, I killed the cop. And you don't listen to me, I'm going to kill you too." So what he wanted was her car. But he kept her. He kidnapped her as well. Mm-hmm. And to get them out of the radius of the police locally. And because that was the Greenwood Cemetery. So sort of just in the around, let's see, Lower Borough.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So off they go. He made her do all the driving. He kept her for 18 and a half hours. I know all the newspapers at the time said that that he let her off unharmed in Wheeling. But I thought, wait a minute, he keeps her 18 and a half hours? So I did a lot of research into this, and I did find out. But I'm still very protective of this person, even in the book. But I did find out she had a very, very nasty fate. She was severely assaulted. And she's made her way after that to the best of her ability. But certainly these things will have some harm for the rest of your life.
Did they go somewhere else? I mean, you could get from Tarentum to Wheeling in a couple of hours.
You can. They went through various states. You know, Maryland, West Virginia, Virginia, maybe touched another state or two, Ohio.
Is this where?
Just driving around. And in the meantime, he would stop and assault this poor girl.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually, I think Hoss didn't know what to do. He knew the entire world was coming down on him. Now, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? So he's got this car, and it's pretty much known. He thought he was pretty free for at least a day because they didn't know she was kidnapped. Mm-hmm. And so he felt fairly safe driving around in this car. Maybe he just plumb didn't know what to do. But he did assault the girl, and he let her go alive in Wheeling. And there, and he kidnapped another. I'm sorry, he didn't kidnap. He let her off alive, but he needed another car. So, because she was going to tell right away, mm-hmm. he's got my car. You know? So he stole another car from a parking lot of a hospital in Wheeling, and off he goes just through whim, just not knowing what to do. But he said, "Well, I'm going to go down this road." He went toward Uniontown. He picked up Route 40, the beautiful National Highway, and made his way all the way to toward Cumberland, Frostburg, Maryland. And he came to this little town called LaVale. And why he stopped there was he ran out of gas. He was going to run out of gas, and he couldn't afford to run out of gas and draw attention to himself on a roadway. So he pulled into it was called a King's Department Store, and it had a parking lot. So he pulled down into there and just sat and sort of formulated another plan. What's he going to do now? Now he has a car that doesn't have any gas. He needs another car. And doesn't another car pull in, one that immediately captures his eye? And in fact, it's on the cover of the book, Born to Lose. That is a 1969 GTO. I think they call it the Gran Turismo Amalgato, the GOAT. And it was a great muscle car, if you remember that.
There was a song about it, a little GTO.
Yeah, a little GTO. So, but driving this GTO was just a lovely woman, 21 years old. Her name was Linda Stewart. That was her maiden name, and she had recently married a Navy guy named Peugeot. And they had a two-year-old daughter, Lori May, and Gerald, the husband, was out to sea on military Navy duty, and she was just doing some shopping for her daughter's birthday party the very next day. And I could only tell you that all of these victims of Stanley Hoss's were enormously wonderful people that we need in this society. And it was, in this case, and in all of his victims, it was like, you know, a monster killing angels. Mm-hmm. And certainly it was so for this pair. The mother was valedictorian of her high school class.
Oh, my.
And they were just a darling pair. And long story short, he kidnapped them when they came out of the store from shopping.
This is the mother and the little girl?
The mother and the little girl. They were in the store for a while shopping and came back out, and he measured his gait and where they would all arrive at the car. He pulled a gun, just get in the car, one word, I'll shoot you right here, and you won't hurt my little girl. So no, get in the car. And now he has them. And this was at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a Monday, which was like 3 days after the cop killing, okay, in Verona, Oakmont. Mm-hmm. And there's so much involved, but I just want to get the essentials here. Linda, the valedictorian of her class, the mother, the young mother, was kidnapped at 1 o'clock, and by 5 o'clock she was dead in the trunk of the car. And he put her in the trunk of the car.
He shot her?
He shot her. And he kept the baby alive with him. And then he made his way up to Franklin, Pennsylvania. And he saw a cop that was sort of sniffing around this motel where he was. And it spooked him. And off he goes again with the child alive and well with him. But the mother is dead in the trunk. And they make their way into Ohio, where he buries the mom. And then keeps the young girl with him, the two-year-old with him, for another week. And I almost don't want to give you all these details because, wow.
It's in the book.
What happens is incredible.
Let me take a break here. I have to remind myself every couple of minutes, Jim Hollick, that this sounds like a novel, you know, a thriller that, you know, somebody's written. And it's all true.
Yeah, all true.
It happened right here in our area. The book is Born to Lose, Stanley B. Haas and the Crime Spree That Gripped a Nation. We'll take a break. We'll come back and continue our conversation with Jim Hollick here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after this.
Music is a bridge between the material and the spiritual. My name is Harvey Lauer, and I'm 82. As a blind person, you have to be aware that nobody can tell you what you can or can't do. You really have to try things. My folks got me a little radio in 1940, and that was the best Christmas present I ever got. When I was 11 years old is when I started to play music, play the piano, and then the accordion, and then the cello. My wife, who was also blind, was a good cook. When she died, that's when I started Meals on Wheels. America, let's do lunch.
One in six seniors faces the threat of hunger, and millions more live in isolation. Drop off a hot meal and say a quick hello. Volunteer for Meals on Wheels by donating your lunch break at americaletsdolunch.org. This message brought to you by Meals on Wheels America and the Ad Council.
Welcome back, listeners. Great to have you with us on It's Your Turn today. Jim Hollick is our guest. He's a Butler native. Worked most of his career in the criminal justice system and researched for many years, by 5 years, this really brutal story of Stanley Haas and this crime spree. And now he's written a book about it. Born to Lose, Stanley B. Haas and the Crime Spree That Gripped a Nation. I imagine by this time, even, you got to remember this is from 1969, we didn't have CNN and Fox News and all the other instantaneous television news that we've got now, but by this time, this has to be a nationwide story, doesn't it?
It has turned certainly to a first, you know, local and then regional, and certainly now it's a national story. And there is, and what brought the FBI in, of course, was the kidnapping of the woman and child, and then crossing state lines. Mm. So the FBI was always just itching to get into this case, and now there is cause for them to jump in with both feet.
I'm assuming that the woman who Haas kidnapped, sexually assaulted multiple times and then let go in Wheeling, she had been able to speak to the police by this time and tell her story.
Yes, she did. And she gave excellent descriptions. The police took what she said as gospel. She was extraordinarily helpful under very trying conditions, given her condition when she went to the police, which is only moments after Haas left Wheeling.
Were they able to tie Haas to the killing of the young woman in Maryland pretty quickly?
No. That's what was fascinating. The girl in Wheeling certainly knew nothing about what was going to happen in the future. So when this pair, the young mother and her daughter, were kidnapped, it was unknown they were gone for another half a day at least. Mm. Although the mother had called the police twice and said, you know, my daughter went shopping and but keep in mind now, Haas, the crimes were taking place up in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And although there were bulletins about an escaped cop killer, was he really in Cumberland? Was he in a little town, LaVale?
Yeah.
Could he have taken this mother and daughter, you know? And it didn't come to light until there were sightings of him with the little girl. And it was all across Ohio. It was interesting. And he would stop a certain... and one time, he stopped in Wellington, Ohio, with a little girl, and he sent a dozen red roses to his mistress. And now they started the link, you know, and the GTO was spotted. And, you know, so they started to make these... all the factors come together and say, gee, this guy has this woman and baby. And where are they? But they didn't know Linda was already dead.
And buried.
And buried by this time. So then he wrote two postcards from, I think, Ottawa, Ohio, Tiffin or Ottawa, Ohio. Mm. And the postcards were taken from the glove box in the GTO, and they were scenes, Florida scenes, Petersburg, where the husband was stationed. So, bingo, you know, they got this guy, and they know for certain, And they, matter of fact, they turned the loose around the ship and brought him back to shore, flew him from Florida to Pittsburgh on military transport, the husband I'm talking about, and got all the information from him. But now it's just clear. We got to get this guy. He's got Linda. He's got the child with him. They don't know what's going on, what exactly, but yeah, he kidnapped them. So now it has really turned into a nationwide manhunt. The FBI is involved. Every police department has literature on this case. And yet the hunt went on. He kept eluding capture.
How long before they finally nailed him?
Well, I would say, let me see now. He escaped on the 19th of September, and he was ultimately captured in Waterloo, Iowa, on October 4.
Did he kill anybody else after he had the, after he killed the woman with the little girl?
Well, he killed a little girl.
Oh, he did?
Oh, yes.
Oh, my God.
You know, how could you do that? You would think that you would bond,
Two-year-old girl.
Two-year-old girl, and she was the most darling thing you could ever picture. He murdered her, and he buried her. And I'm almost certain I know where the mother is buried, but I don't think she could ever be found. But I think I know where the little girl is buried, but it would take some, you know, resources, time, and all to see if she could be discovered after all these years. And that would be around the Missouri-Kansas border.
Was Haas taken alive or was he killed?
Haas, with great struggle, was taken alive. An enormous fight in a small parking lot outside a diner in Waterloo, Iowa. And had he not left his gun in the car because he didn't want to put a jacket on to cover it up on his warm day, he'd have shot everybody in sight.
We're talking about Born to Lose, Stanley B. Haas, and the crime spree that gripped the nation. Did they bring him back to Pennsylvania to stand trial?
Yes, they brought him back to Pennsylvania. He was taken to court eventually. And I'll say this. We have a very famous guy in Pittsburgh, and we all know of him, Edgar Snyder.
The lawyer. And Edgar, the guy with the TV commercial.
The the famous lawyer, Edgar Snyder. He was just a young buck at the time, like many people were. Dick Thornburgh was involved with this case. You know, he was a young guy. Cyril Wecht and Edgar Snyder. So you had some big names. And then later on, a little bit, Governor Schapp. But Edgar Snyder was a young guy out of Pitt Law School. And he was just plucked from anonymity, really. A very small office. There couldn't have been two or three people in a public defender's office because just before that, there weren't any public defender's office. So, but he wound up defending Stanley Haas. And Edgar and I have been out on any number of personal appearances together about the case. So it's really great working with Edgar.
We're talking with Jim Hollick, for those of you who may have joined us a little bit late in our conversation here. He's written a book about all of this. And as I mentioned before, you have to stop every once in a while and remind yourself that this isn't a novel that's been doctored up to make it more exciting. You know, it really happened. The book is entitled Born to Lose, Stanley B. Haas and the crime spree that gripped the nation. He was tried. Was he convicted?
He was tried for the killing of Officer Joe Zanella, and he was convicted, and he was given the death penalty. But, you know, Dave, nothing is quite for certain in this country. I think this is why maybe people have begun to distrust the criminal justice system, because here we have a cop killing. A cop killing, almost an execution. All the evidence was there. The people, the jury system, us, the people, said he's to be put to death, and it never came about. I do go into this in the book, give all the details, because I really wanted people to know what happened. Mm-hmm. How could this be? And then something more absolutely dumbfounding is he was also to be brought to trial for the kidnapping and murder of a young mother and of a child. And he even confessed to it. And do you know for technicalities, he walked away from the darkest crime in Maryland history. Stanley Haas didn't serve a day.
He was never convicted of
murder? Never convicted, and that is detailed with some really a fascinating story of how this came about.
Did he actually go to trial in Maryland, or was it just...
He was not brought to trial.
Huh.
So, again, and this frustrates the citizens. You know, how are we to be protected?
Yeah, absolutely.
And then it even gets worse, but I'll let you go ahead here.
Is he still alive?
Stanley Haas is not alive. He did what we should have maybe done to him. Hanged in Greaterford Prison in 1978.
He hanged himself?
Well, not according to Edgar Snyder, nor his mistress, nor his wife. They said, no, he did not hang himself. He loved himself too much, and, you know, along these lines. My contention is he did kill himself. He was depressed. His really day was over. Had he been able to kill more and more, I think he'd have thrived on that. And he wanted to be the most infamous criminal in Pennsylvania history. Probably he attained that. Because when all thought all this carnage was over, it wasn't. And he went on to kill again in extraordinary circumstances where you would think, how could a prisoner like Stanley Haas kill a very well-respected black officer at Western Penitentiary, one of the very first blacks hired down there?
He killed a prison guard while
he was in prison. Killed a great guy named Walter Peterson. Not only was he a corrections officer, but he was rising through the ranks. He, you know, became a sergeant, then a lieutenant. And at the time of his death, which he was picked out, it was maybe a hate crime before we knew the term, he was chosen for murder by Stanley Haas and two other white thugs down there in a high security area. And I'm telling you, Dave, it was a death by inches, a brutal torture killing. And Stanley Haas, if you want to say how he kept getting off with these things, he was up to his blood, or up to his elbows in the victim's blood. It was right there. It was witnessed. And the jury said, well, he did it, but he didn't really plan to do it. And it was outrageous, outrageous.
Take a final break. We'll wrap up our conversation with Jim Hollick here on It's Your Turn on WISR about his book, Born to Lose. We'll do that right after these words.
I can't remember the last time I went to the dentist. Now I'm too embarrassed to go because my teeth are in such bad condition.
Unfortunately, this person is not alone. Many folks put off going to the dentist because they fear being scolded for neglecting their teeth. This is Dr. Bob Todd with a special message. Dentistry today is faster, easier, and better than ever before. At our dental office, we don't believe in making you feel guilty, no matter how long it has been since you've seen a dentist. We know fear and embarrassment can cause a cycle of procrastination. If it has been years since you've been to the dentist, call us today. We will help put your mind at ease and bring your smile back to health.
If you hate going to the dentist but know you have a dental problem, help is only a phone call away. Dr. Bob Todd and his friendly dental team will answer all your questions and care for all your concerns. For complimentary information or to schedule an appointment at their Butler office on Evan City Road, please call 282-7774 or on the web at butlersmiles.com.
Welcome back, listeners. We have only a few minutes left to wrap up our conversation with Jim Hollick, author of Born to Lose, Stanley B. Haas and the Crime Spree That Gripped a Nation. The local connection here, it's a fascinating story even without a local connection. Jim Hollick is a Butler High grad, so he's a native son. Stanley Haas, this horrible criminal that we've been talking about, was born and raised in Saxonburg, for goodness sake. So there's quite a bit of local connection here. There's a lot of testimonials for Jim's book. I'm only going to read one, and it's by a person you all know, Dr. Cyril Wecht, who, by the way, has been a guest on this program.
Wow.
Cyril was with us. We were talking about the John F. Kennedy assassination.
Oh, yeah.
When he was here. Here's what Cyril Wecht said about Jim's book. Born to Lose, I'm quoting, Born to Lose is a fascinating read, an extraordinary book. The amount of work that went into compiling this account of a criminal madman is staggering, and yet it reads like a fictional suspense thriller. Well done, Cyril Wecht. I'm assuming you've obviously talked to Dr. Wecht.
And, oh, yes.
Did you ever talk to any of the other principals? Were some of the investigating officers, detectives, homicide guys still alive?
Oh, virtually all. Many, many interviews. I have maybe a couple hundred hours of taped interviews, and all the conversation is interwoven. It's like it's right from the horse's mouth. It's like listening to two cops talking to others about the case.
It's good that you did this. I've just noticed in the past year or so, more and more of the investigating officers from the O.J. Simpson case are passing away.
Yes, it is. Because
never be able to talk to them again.
Some of the principals that are in the book over the last couple years have passed away now.
There's one other point that Jim wanted to make, and we were talking about it during the break here. Yes, this reads like a thriller, as Dr. Wecht said, and it's riveting for us because of the local connection, but we don't want to glorify this guy. This guy was a devil. He was a madman. He was a horrible, violent criminal. And you don't glorify him in this book, do you, Jim?
No, I think that if anybody reads this book, they will come away knowing that many of these criminals, certainly Stanley Haas, is an empty character. He did not, and he will never fit into society. He was far different from us, which sometimes draws us to wanting to learn a little bit more about these characters or the character of these people. But there's no glorification. You will find out that Haas was really an empty soul. He treated people poorly, and in the end, you will pay for that. He wound up in prison. Maybe we should have executed him, but we wound up not doing that due to whatever reasons we had in the courts. And he faced nothing but endless loneliness. He was in isolation. He lived in maybe the size of your bathroom for years. And I might say that the guy that killed Officer Peterson in the prison, along with Stanley Haas, there were two of them, George Butler, who died of an aneurysm some years ago. But Danny Delker is the sole remaining murderer of Captain Peterson. And we, meaning the prison system, put him in isolation back in 1973 when Peterson was killed. He is there to this day in a Pennsylvania prison. I visited him maybe 18 months ago to see if I could get more of a confession, you know, from him. But he is the longest serving prisoner in isolation in America today. So the case goes on.
Nice to have you here, Jim.
I'm happy to be here, Dave. Thank you.
Jim Hollick, our guest on It's Your Turn today. That is one fascinating story. Gruesome, very violent. I warned you going in that it was a violent crime, a bloody, horrible crime. But fascinating stuff. And Stanley Haas, the bad guy, born and raised in Saxonburg, for goodness sakes. Wow. All of this taking place back in 1969, so it's a long time ago. Jim Hollick writing about it. It's James G. Hollick, Hollock, if you're looking for his book, paperback, called Born to Lose. Born to Lose. And, it's got that picture of the GTO, the Pontiac GTO on the cover. That figured, of course, in that horrible, horrible crime spree. Now, if you can imagine, back in 1969, we just had, radio, TV, and newspapers. That was the mass media of the day. And we did not have 24-hour cable news. Now we have three 24-hour news channels, CNN and Fox and MSNBC. And they, can you imagine? They'd have been all over this story, my goodness. That camera set up and crews and everything. Not that it would have been great. I mean, it was a horrible thing, but wow, we would have been all over the news for days and days. And of course, there was no social media back in those days either, so there was no discussion among people online about this horrible crime spree. Well, there's more to come on It's Your Turn today. I do want to remind you that coming up tomorrow, we'll be talking with Larry Black and Michael Harvey about pro-life issues. They'll be with us here in the studio tomorrow. We're also going to be talking tomorrow about living more simply with the guest Courtney Carver, who says, you know, really, you can live with less and have a lot more. And, I wondered about this at times. You know, look about at all the stuff we have and consumer goods and how much we buy, and maybe especially at Christmas time, right? Yeah. So we'll talk about that tomorrow. Coming up later in the week, we'll be talking about the Atkins diet. Is that still around? Well, yes, it is, actually. We'll be talking about healthy eating into the new year. And we'll also be talking about resolutions for a green 2080. A green 2080, saving the environment. That'll be later in the week as well. Okay, we'll take a quick break here. We'll be hooking up with our next guest. I'm anxious to meet him. He is Justin. He's a new educator at Penn State Extension. His name is Justin Brackenrich, agronomy educator at Penn State Extension here in Butler County. And he'll be with us coming up here on the It's Your Turn program in just a moment or so. Okay, yeah, be right back.
Leave the driving up to us. We're going your way. Getting there stops here. Just hop the bus. Easy and economical. Just hop the bus. No car, no problem. The bus will get you there. 'Cause that's what we do. Hop the bus. Leave the driving up to us. We're going your way.
After exploding for 5 goals in Philadelphia, the Penguins return home from the road trip coming off a big win as they meet the Carolina Hurricanes at PPG Paints Arena. You can tune in at 6:30 p.m. for Penguins pregame. Puck drop is at 7 o'clock in Pittsburgh. It's the Penguins and the Canes on the Penguins Radio Network. This is Paul Steigerwald inviting you to join us for all the action.
Pittsburgh Penguins Hockey brought to you in part by Tribe Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers, Hunter Truck Sales, Thrower Concrete, Monday Shoes, Camisa's Auto Body, Butler Agway, A&D Heating and Cooling, and Cash Dollar and Associates.
Welcome back, good friends. Great to have you with us on the program today. And as I mentioned earlier today, and then just a moment or so ago, we're anxious to meet a new Penn State Extension educator who's only been here at Penn State Extension in Butler County for about a month now. His name is Justin Brackenrich, and he's sitting right across the table from me right now. Justin, nice to meet you. Nice to have you here.
It's good to be here. It's nice to meet you, too.
Yeah. And it's true. You're on the job for just a few weeks, right?
Yeah. We moved up here just, I think, 2 weeks. 2 weeks into November, so the middle of November was my start date. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you specialize in any particular area as an extension educator?
So I'm on the Penn State Field and Forage Group. At my previous job, I was a nutrient management planner and worked on nutrient cycling and pasture management related to beef cattle.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm kind of transitioning into the role of working with field crops, as well as still doing that forage aspect that I had done previously to this.
Now, the new model, and it continues to evolve for extension here in Pennsylvania, and I'm sure in other states as well, you serve more of a regional geographical area, right?
That's correct. So I'm centralized in Butler. Now we have 4 members of our team actually kind of in this western Pennsylvania portion. We have one in Armstrong, one in Butler, one in Mercer, and one in Crawford. So we're really doing the whole western portion of Pennsylvania is kind of split up between the 4 of us is how mm-hmm. we can cover it.
That's a lot of territory.
Yeah, it is a lot of ground to cover.
Western half of Pennsylvania is about 30 counties, and you got four people, huh? This is more of the, and I'm searching for the right word here, it's not traditional thoughts of Penn State. Well, I guess it is, because when Penn State Extension got underway, when extension programs in other parts of the country got underway, the focus was mostly on agriculture, right?
Mm-hmm.
Farming. Whether it was, you know, beef cattle, ranches, dairy cattle, whatever, vegetable crops. And, of course, extension has now expanded into quite a few other areas. In fact, over the past couple of years, we've met some fascinating people who work for Penn State Extension in areas like woodlands, water safety, and, you know, all that sort of thing, even home economics. But you're more of a traditional agricultural-based guy.
Well, and I think, you know, that's part of the not a problem, but a challenge that's associated with extension is our job is to connect the university with the people in the communities. And so traditionally, you know, 70 years ago, people had small family farms, and it was a more simplified system, maybe a simplified model where you were working with people, and now agriculture diversifies, so then extension is forced to diversify to keep up, and we have vegetable producers, and timber is becoming a big agricultural product, and we have so many different places that we're working that it's our challenge to keep up with how the society and continuing to transfer that science from the university to the people in our counties.
Yeah, and also better use of person power. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't all that many years ago that each individual county had an extension director, and there would be, you know, two or three people that worked at that particular county office, and that was it. You didn't really share a great many resources with the neighboring counties, but that model's all changed now.
Well, and it allows us to be better at more specific things. You know, before, as we had one person in a county that was supposed to cover, you know, all of these things that could be happening within a county, things tended to fall through the cracks, and they weren't as up to date on some of the research as maybe they should have been. But now that we can specialize, I can go back to my team and talk to those people and really get better to help the people that are within my sector of where I'm supposed to be, rather than trying to cover everything.
Well, I want to talk a little bit specifically about some of your work, but maybe we can talk a little bit about your background. Many Penn State Extension educators are graduates of Penn State. I'm pausing here because I happen to know that Justin is from enemy territory. Where'd you go to school?
So I went to West Virginia University, WVU. I grew up, born and raised in the eastern panhandle of West Virginia. We bordered on Virginia in two sides. Went from there to Morgantown. When I first got to Morgantown, I wanted to do veterinary medicine, so I did an undergrad in animal and nutritional science.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I realized was I spent so much time learning about how to take care of animals, I didn't learn anything about how to feed those animals or what else those animals needed besides just to be healthy. And so then I went back and did my master's in agronomy to learn about the soils and the plants that we have to make those animals, because without one part, the others really don't matter. And so I put all that together, and then after I graduated, I worked for WVU Extension for a short period of time on kind of a research grant, wrapping up some stuff for them before moving here and getting this opportunity with Penn State.
I'm just trying to think, and I'm going back a minute or so here, because you said you grew up in the eastern panhandle of West Virginia, and when I think of the panhandle, I'm usually thinking of that little arm that shoots up toward Steubenville, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
But there's an eastern panhandle, too, with Virginia on both sides. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, where it comes down, it kind of squares off at the bottom side and kind of wraps around Virginia. And we're actually one of the larger, where I grew up was one of the larger counties. But, we're right over there on Virginia. So.
Now, did you come from an agricultural family, Justin?
Both of my parents were are federal employees with the Natural Resource Conservation Service, and so we did farm some, but jobs kind of took, you know, first priority. But growing up in a rural area, I mean, it was kind of a rite of passage as a boy to work for somebody on their farm.
Yeah.
And so most of my younger years and stuff, that was the best place to get a job, was baling hay, or we have a lot of poultry, and so I picked eggs and chicken houses and worked in turkey plants. So I come from a kind of a diversified agricultural background.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about what your schedule is here. Obviously, you're only on board for a couple of months here, but have you lined up some programs already for Western Pennsylvania?
So one of the members of my team in Crawford County has really been doing Butler County up until the point that I got here.
Mm-hmm.
And so Joel had most everything already in place. So it was great to be able to come in and not have to figure all of this stuff out right off the bat and not feel like the people were being slighted. And so it's been great to kind of be involved with him and see how all of this planning goes. But, yeah, we have a pretty full schedule coming up over the next couple months of things in Butler County and in some surrounding counties.
You obviously developed an interest early on in life in this area, nutrient management. Can you explain some of these terms for us so that we make sure that we're all, everybody's on the same page here? Nutrient management, what does that entail?
So nutrient management is it's a really a comprehensive way to look at all of the nutrients on your farm. I know that sounds kind of... So what I would do is we would look at the soils and we would see what nutrients you had there at mm-hmm. the current time, and we would look at what you were bringing into your farm as feeds or as fertilizers, and we would help you to manage those nutrients the best way possible, the most economic way, but also to create the least environmental impact. A long time ago, fertilizer became really available, and people were putting it on and doing a great job of making more and more crops. But then we had a huge fallout over that, and so we see this eutrophication in like the Chesapeake Bay and the Mississippi and some of these really water-polluted areas. And so now we're learning that we need to pay more attention to the environment as well as our economic base and get the most out of our money, but also take care of our resources we have.
Yeah, I can remember when I was a kid and you study, elementary geography and geology and that sort of thing. You talk about erosion prevention, mm-hmm. Whether it's in a farm field or along a road or in your backyard, for that matter, and the importance of planting crops and so on to keep soil from eroding.
Right.
What we really didn't realize so much at that time, that when the soil erodes and goes into the neighboring stream or gulch or whatever and eventually into a larger stream or river, the fertilizers that you put on the fields are going in there too. It's not just the topsoil, right?
Right, and that's really been the big part of it is a lot of this water pollution, like 86% of the phosphorus in our surface water and groundwater is believed to come from agricultural runoff.
Hmm.
And the biggest cause for that is that we don't have plans. We're not monitoring that erosion. We're not keeping it from happening. We're not getting the most that we can out of our soils. And so that was kind of where I fit into this was with my backgrounds of animals as well as soils, I was able to take all of the pieces of a farm and an operation and put those together and see a whole picture and not just look at the soils. And so we kind of get caught up in that is all we can control is grass and soils. Well, that's not true. We can change some things about the animals that will also help fix some of these problems.
What color is the dirt in West Virginia, by the way? I've noticed that as you go south from Pennsylvania, and you can see this in road cuts along mm-hmm. interstates probably more readily than anywhere else, the color of the dirt changes.
Yeah, so kind of in that northern area, that eastern panhandle, we have still pretty brown, nice loamy soil. But as we mm-hmm. move south and west, it gets really red.
Yeah,
we get
a
lot
red.
Of heavy clay over there.
Yeah, yeah. I can remember driving south a few times and seeing that. It's really kind of striking. Yeah,
and so when you think about that stuff, and even further south, Alabama, Arkansas, some of those places, but I didn't realize just how red some of the soils in our state were. Just pretty interesting.
You see some red soil out in central Pennsylvania. Right. Now, does the soil type affect how nutrients run off into streams? Do some soils tend to retain this better than others do? Is that one of the things you look at?
Yes. Yeah, so that's their characteristics of the soil. So phosphorus, when we look at that, phosphorus mostly travels through surface water or erosion that we talked about earlier, mm-hmm. and soils all have an erodibility factor. Different soils will erode at different rates, and they can hold up to the pressures of water and wind at different rates. Nitrogen, however, you know, it moves vertically, through groundwater, and so as it runs out the bottom, different soils have a different leaching characteristic, and so all of that kind of goes into, as we figure out plans, how erodible is your soil to help transport that phosphorus to a waterway? How long will your soil be able to hold this nitrogen in place without it going into groundwater? There are a lot of different pieces that can affect how these things work.
I'm trying to remember nitrogen, phosphorus. Boy, this is going back many, many years. Why am I thinking of potash? Is that something else that's in fertilizers?
Yeah, so potassium.
Potassium, okay.
But the most common way that people describe that would be potash. That would be the fertilizer component of potassium is potash.
Can you detect all this stuff by soil testing? I mean, is it as simple as that?
Yes. So we come out, we take some soil samples of your farm, we put them, we take some notes and stuff, and we can send them to Penn State, and they'll give us all of the information as to what nutrients are in your soil. As to your potential for runoff and your potential for leaching, all of that stuff was mapped years ago, and so it's all available online through the NRCS's web soil survey. You can go to your farm and you can look at it and see all of the characteristics of your soils, what cropping systems may they be best for, how they would work with a septic system, how they would work for buildings, roads, houses. Mm-hmm. Just a fantastic piece of information to have.
There's a lot of information that's valuable whether you have a farm or not.
Right? Absolutely. And so that's the thing is, so some of our vegetable producers, and when I worked in West Virginia, we would do chemical mixing stations for orchards. And so if you were spraying a lot of pesticides or herbicides and stuff there, those soil factors would come into where would be the best place suited to put that building to control some of the runoff and, keep, if you do have a spill, hopefully you don't because you're building this facility, but if you do, the characteristics that would affect how that stuff would move.
One more question before we take a break here. Another one of your interests was pasture management. I have no experience on a farm, didn't come from a family farm, but had friends, when I was in school who came from farm families, and I thought they just kind of did the same thing every year in terms of pasture. I mean, you rotate crops, you wouldn't grow corn in the same field every year or soybeans or whatever, but it didn't seem to be a whole lot of research-based science behind it. Has that changed?
Yeah, absolutely. So, pastures were just what you said. They were where we put our cows during the summertime, and that's how they were treated.
Yeah, and the next year it might be a different pasture, but it was not
right.
The same. Yeah.
And so then people realized, and the universities and the operators, they if I don't just turn them out there and just leave them alone, if I move them and I rotate these cows from smaller paddocks more often, I can get better growth out of my grass. And if I treat this more as a crop and I fertilize and I lime it, I can get more growth potential. There's a lot of research now with using different grasses. So our cool season grasses we see, they kind of slump off during the hottest parts of the month, like January and August. And so, July and August. we see a real drop in the availability of food. And we're working now to get some different grasses that would provide more food that would do better in those hotter temperatures of the year so we don't see that summer slump in our grazing potential. Land, we don't make more land, and so we're just having to get better at using what we've got.
We're meeting and talking for the first time with the new Penn State Extension educator. He is an agronomy educator, started work here in Butler County in did you say early December?
Early November.
Early November. Yep. His name is Justin Brackenridge, and we'll pick up our conversation with him again in just a moment or so. One of our sponsors on the program today is the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler with their thrift store. Have you been there, by the way? It's in the Greater Butler Mart, Route 8 South, and it's really a very nice place. It really is. And here's the thing. All of the proceeds from the operation of the thrift store by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul, All the proceeds stay here locally in Butler County, and they help to fund their food bank, the St. Vincent Paul Food Bank, and their client aid program. So they'd ask you, you know, and you're doing cleaning or whatever, if you have excess items that you're thinking about throwing away, don't put them in the landfill. Take them to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. Could be clothing, could be shoes, knickknacks, furniture. If you have a lot of stuff, they'll come and pick it up. You can call them and they'll come with their truck. I had a neighbor of mine a couple of years ago who was downsizing, moving away, and she had a dining room suit and something else, and she was stumped. I didn't know what to do with it. I said, call St. Vincent de Paul. So she was rid of the stuff, and somebody else got to use it at a good price. And again, the proceeds helped to fund the food bank and the client aid program. The thrift store in the Greater Butler Mart is open Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. There's tons of free parking right outside the door, and the drop-off bins, if you're dropping stuff off, right inside the door. I mean, it's like a couple of seconds and you're there. Society of St. Vincent de Paul. They like to say we stand tallest when we stoop to help others. Nice thought. Be right back.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick 2 is 880. The pick 3, 463. The pick 4, 6925. The pick 5, 99899. All ball for each of those is 0. The treasure hunt is 8, 9, 17, 23, and 27. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $10,000.
Welcome back, good friends. Nice to have you with us on the It's Your Turn program today. Justin Brackenridge is with us here in the studio. He's a new agronomy educator that just started work late last year. Seems funny to talk about 2017 as last year, doesn't it? Here in Butler County, comes from West Virginia. So we mentioned there are a number of programs and events coming up. How can farm families or others, for that matter, register or find out about these events? Are they listed online somewhere, Justin? Or?
So, yeah, a great place to look is at our Penn State website for the calendar of events that we have coming up. We actually sent out some mailings last week to somewhere around 3,000 people in the western portion of Pennsylvania. So, you know, hopefully we can get as many people involved to our days as we can. But I've actually brought a list of some of them. If we've got a little time, maybe I could
please
do through
go
some
right
of
ahead.
Them.
Yes, do.
For the people that are interested that have their pesticide license, we will be doing our 2+2 meetings this summer with the two category, or excuse me, this winter, the two category and the two core credits. Those will be $10 a person. So again, you can look on our website. If you just Google the Penn State Agronomy pesticide update, you'll find the location where all of those are being offered and the times.
So it's a requirement to update that that knowledge every
so
often?
Yes, so every 3 years, if you possess an applicator's license, you have to have continuing education units to continue to keep that license. And so part of them have to be core units, which would relate to anybody. If you're spraying for weeds or pests or, bugs or anything like that, that's the information that you have to have just to be able to be safe, to winterize your sprayer and limit your drift, where the other things, the categories can be more specific, but are still, it's kind of at your choice as to which ones of those you take.
This is all good stuff. In years gone by, I didn't have to have a license to do any of this stuff, and we didn't realize some of the dangers, some of the health hazards. Yeah.
So, again, we've got some coming up in Butler County. There's 5 of them actually going to be at our office. One thing that we are doing differently this year, Penn State has asked us to no longer do registration in our office, so we have an 800 number that if you got a mailing, you would see. That way they can keep it centralized. You know, where we had 20 offices in western Pennsylvania or participating in these web series, you never really could get a super accurate head count as to who was going to be there because people were calling every different office, and every office had a list. And so now what we're doing is doing it through Penn State itself at main campus. So that way they have an idea, and you can get on these lists for mailings, and they can keep track of your information there a little better than having 20 different lists floating around the state.
You also have what's called a Butler Crops Day coming up, and that'll be next month in February, late February, and that'll be at the Atrium here in Butler County, which is Prospect area just west of Butler. This is a pretty big deal, right? I mean, is this held every year?
So, you know, coming in this new, I don't know. I think that we have them in this area. At least we try to do one major day as far as a crops day or
and
a workshop or something.
This is a full day of
absolutely.
Lessons and stuff like that.
Yeah, and so we're kind of pulling our resources now that we have more educators over here. We're getting some of the extension specialists from Penn State at College Park to come over and give some of their talks, but also we have different educators that have different backgrounds, and so I'll be giving a talk on nutrient management. We have another educator in Mercer County that'll be talking about cover crops. The educator from Crawford County will be doing stuff on weed management. So we're really trying to get as many different groups involved as we can and showcase what we know. And, you know, again, even with how things are moving, we all don't have to be good at everything. So we need to know what the other educators know as well so that we can work together as a team.
That's February 28th, lunch included. It's an all-day event. Is it too early to register for that, or are you already?
No, it is online. You can go ahead and get started, or you can call the 800 number that would be on that mailer that you would get. Mm-hmm. And if you have any other questions, you can always call the Penn State office here in Butler, and I can, you know, one of us could direct you to the number or the website or something to get you set up for any of this stuff.
Now, you also have, and this is in March, which we'll be here before we know it, and for most folks suffering through this bitter cold, none too soon, you have a hay production workshop. And boy, just about every farm has at least some hay production, don't they?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, it's kind of like the pasture that we talked about before. There's a lot of potential for good feeding and taking advantage of the hay that we have. It doesn't always have to be dry hay that we just give the cows when it's cold. You know, we can really manage that quality of them. And so that's what we're going to be talking about at this Crops Day is how we can produce high-quality forages and how we can cut the cost of producing a higher quality. We also want to talk about controlling weeds to cut down on undesirables. But if you're in one of those cases where you just have the land, we also are going to work with marketing and how you can sell the hay that you do have and be able to get full advantage out of the marketing in this side of the state.
I was reading about it, runaway weeds that are overrunning some, well, farms and other properties too, especially if you have a stream or a creek that goes through your property. And you need to be able to control. I guess if you let these go, they can, it's the end. I mean, you can't get rid of them.
Yeah, and it can really just be, it's one of those things that once they get started, you have to be so proactive to keep up with it that, you know, in West Virginia, I don't know, I haven't been here in the summertime, so I haven't seen, you know, the green up, but we have problems with thistles. And, you know, you see one thistle, and the next thing you know, there's 1,000 thistles. And then before you know it, your neighbor has a thistle problem. And it's just a really good example of how those seeds can float and how you have to be proactive, because it's not just you. And people would say, you know, well, I don't have them on my place. Well, you know, encourage your neighbor to take care of them, because one day they'll be at your place possibly. So it's good to work together and get this information out as best we can.
Folks, as we mentioned at the beginning, extension has changed. This is all across the country, by the way. Extension was started with the land-grant university systems back in the 1800s, for that matter. Penn State, I think, started in 1859. And every state has what's designated as a land-grant university, and extension programs operate out of that school. So you get research-based programs and education. And, of course, here in our state, it's Penn State Extension. They have a lot more programs. You can always call or check online. Penn State Extension covers a lot more than just agronomy these days. In fact, something that I failed to mention earlier when we were running down some of the areas, water safety
and environmental protection, woodlands. There are even educators who work with the fracking concerns nowadays, whether it's landowners who have, you know, leased their property for natural gas drilling. So maybe you can get some information. Maybe they can help you. Most all of these areas have regular programs and workshops and so on. Justin, nice to meet you. Nice to have you here today.
You as well. Thank you for having me.
Yes. Welcome to Butler.
Are you
kind of settled in? Are you okay with our community so far?
Yeah.
A couple of months in?
It's it's different than home, but it's pretty familiar still. You know, a lot of agriculture and a lot of really nice people.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was a transition to a new place, but it's a pretty familiar place to be for me. So.
And it's not like, you know, I mean, you can get home in a few hours. It's not like you have to go to Brazil or something, you know.
For us, it's fantastic because I can be from my office to home in about 15 minutes, and I live off the road, in the trees, by a lake. But I can also be to, you know, Lowe's in 10 minutes. It's just, it's the best of everything you could ever ask for.
I know so many people who have talked about Butler that way. And you haven't been here too long yet, but it's the same thing if you want to zip down to Pittsburgh.